Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law, our legal systems, and our legal procedures. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and today I'm joined by my co-host, as always, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. In this episode, we're going to talk about the patchwork of state court decisions and legislation about abortion. We'll focus on Georgia, Louisiana, and Ohio. During this presidential campaign, former President Donald Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance have said that the abortion issue is solved because each state now has the right to pass its own laws. State legislators and legislatures have been busy. What has resulted is a patchwork of restrictive statutes that are now being examined by our state courts. We have all kinds of issues going on with abortion, Judge Gail. Leaving the laws up to states has just been a nightmare from a legal perspective, because we have actions being taken by state legislators. Some are involved in the MAGA movement that are antithetical to the Constitution or certain laws. And what we're having is one state doing one thing, another state doing another state doing another. And regardless of what the legislator or legislatures have done, they're now, all these matters are now working their way to state courts. And we're getting some good decisions, and we're getting some really crappy decisions. Would that be a correct characterization?
I think it is an absolutely correct characterization. But for the fact that I think I would call this a disaster, but it is absolutely the disaster that has been specifically crafted and manufactured by the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision. It is something that should have been expected and anticipated when, for more than five decades, the entire country enjoyed the standard that had long been articulated and preserved under Roe v. Wade. And to have that standard gutted and eviscerated in exchange for, as what you've just called, a patchwork of precedent, which we all knew would be coming, and has resulted in horrific results in some areas and in some states, while the preservation of pre-existing rights has remained intact in other states, is something, it is a tailspin. It is a whirlwind that I think can only be laid at the feet of the U.S. Supreme Court justices who essentially created and brought us the havoc that is being experienced from coast to coast and throughout this nation, and it is abominable.
Let's start with Georgia, and let me say that the Georgia State Legislature passed, I just hate these catchy terms that they come up with.
The Life Act?
Yeah. Living Infants Fairness and Equality Act, or LIFE, was passed by the Georgia legislature, banning abortions if there was a fetal heartbeat, when a fetal heartbeat is detected, usually around six weeks, absent a, quote, medical emergency. Now, this law carried with it penalties, felony penalties, for people who would violate the law, up to 5 years in jail and a $5,000 fine. And, you know, other doctors and so forth became so afraid of this that they refused to take action. And, Judge, I want you to talk, if you could, about the Amber Thurman case before we get into the current judicial case.
So Amber Thurman was a 26-year-old African-American female mother to a 6-year-old who became pregnant again and determined that it was a pregnancy that she did not wish to carry to term. And because Georgia had passed this now draconian law through its legislature, had to seek health care to address this out of state. And so she went out of state to receive care, returned to Georgia, where she had complications as a result of it. And in the back and forth between the two, she actually developed complications that caused her health to devolve. And she went to the hospital in Georgia to seek care. It was determined that she would need what's called a DNC to help.
And not to get too much in the weeds, but that is not a complicated procedure.
It is not.
It's a fairly routine procedure in situations like this. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You are correct. It is very common. And she was denied it. And the denial of this resulted in her developing sepsis and dying.
And obviously, they put her in the hospital. She waited. She was a nurse assistant, so she knew what was going on. Her infection kept getting worse and worse. And when they finally thought that it constituted a medical emergency, then they went ahead and tried to perform the DNC, and by that time, she was too far gone and died. You know, a terrible, terrible situation. That was not the only situation, however. There was another woman named Candy Miller. Now, she was 41 years old. She also was giving the abortion medication. It did not work. She was in the same kind of situation that Amber Thurman was in. And instead, she stayed home, did not seek medical attention, and she died in her bed with her 3-year-old daughter by her side. Now, these are two just grotesque situations of the outcome of this law called LIFE, the Living Infants Fairness and Equality Act. So this case, or not those cases, those will be resolved through civil medical malpractice cases, Amber Thurman and Candy Miller, I am sure. But going back to the constitutionality of the criminal law, Georgia's Governor Brian Kemp was, when he signed this law into action, said this law values life. It says that life has value.
Well, at least some lives have value.
Yeah, talk about that. How do you, you know, that just you prioritize one life over another? Is that what that means?
Indeed, and I think what's lost here is the fact that there's a failure to recognize that the life of the mother also has value, and that. Also, in so many of these instances, Georgia being one of them, the law is written in such a vague way that doctors don't even know how or when
They don't know what a medical emergency is,
yes,
right?
There's no definition of it. And therefore, having sworn this Hippocratic Oath, they aren't even certain when that is triggered, given the now legal constraints that they operate under. And certain doctors are not willing to substitute their judgment for that of judges or the legislature or the court. They are erring on what they believe is the side of caution, and often to the detriment of their patients. Look at the two cases you just outlined in the state of Georgia, and the outcomes have been everything but what a doctor would have hoped to have done. I think if you ask any doctor, they will happily engage in Herculean efforts to help save the life of their patient. And being tethered to a law that gives them no options to do so, or not understanding when that is not what they interpret or anticipated or even got into this profession to do, to essentially watch their patients die, knowing they could do something to save them, and then to have the rebuttal on the part of non-doctors, which are often the legislators, the lawyers, and other individuals controlling their behavior, telling them, well, you know what, we value life. And the doctor is saying, which one? Which life are you valuing? Because there's clearly a life here to save. And in some instances, there's no possibility of viability of the fetus. And so which life are we really valuing? And how are you able to make that determination when you're in, if you were in my shoes as a doctor and you know what your responsibility is? That's what makes a lot of this abhorrent. There are also a lot of other permutations about it that make it, you know, rather challenging and abhorrent, but this makes it really, really hard for them.
Well, in Georgia, just recently, a state court judge, a state superior court judge, Robert C.J. McBurney, a Republican appointee, by the way, found the Georgia life statutes to be unconstitutional. But he also made a sort of jab back at the governor, who said that the bill said that life now has value. Judge McBurney said that he agreed that every life is worth protection, not just the life of an unborn child or a fetus, including the lives of women and girls who get pregnant. He sort of expanded that definition. That was a good sign right out of the box. He wrote a 26-page decision, and I've read several things this week, Judge Gale, that he really took on Justice Samuel Alito of the U.S. Supreme Court's reasoning in the Dobbs case, which reversed Roe versus Wade.
Really
took it on and criticized also the popular stance of Trump and other Republicans about sending the issue back to the states. Interesting fact.
Can I say something about that?
Sure.
Just really quickly?
The
judge is, you know, this idea of sending the issue back to the states and suggesting that this is perhaps where it should be, or this is the place where it ought to be, and this is the place where it's best decided, I think, first of all, has really awakened a lot of us to the fact that that things were fine the way they were, given the consistent response in state after state after state, and saying, no, this is a right that deserves to have been preserved because we've enjoyed it for 50 years. And why are we disturbing what need not have been disturbed in the first place? That's number one. And number two, if in fact the states is where this should be and where it should be decided, then I just struggle to understand why there are so many folks in so many states in so many instances that are working overtime. I mean, as if they don't need a wink of sleep. they work overtime to make sure that the issues never get to the ballot so that they can be decided by the states. If that is, if you trusted the electorate, if you trusted the constituency, if in fact your faith is that in the people who are to be governed by these decisions, and that those decisions will break the way that, you know, some hope and others would not, then why do you work so hard to limit their access to voicing their preference through the ballot box? Because that's what I see the exercise being over and over and over again, and Ohio being one of those examples.
Yeah, and we'll get to Ohio towards the end of the program and really jump in depth on that. This Georgia situation, however, interesting that the judge made his decision on unconstitutionality based on the Georgia Constitution and not the federal Constitution. Did that seem appropriate to you, Judge?
I mean, given the fact that this is now, again, an issue that's been returned to the state court, and you are now asking state court judges to make these determinations in the shadows of their own state constitutions, it seems to track, at least in my opinion, it would track. But like you, I am really encouraged at the fact that, you know, even in following the law and the logic of the Georgia state constitution, that in this instance, the judge here, Judge McBurney, actually took on one of the U.S. Supreme Court justices' rationale for why we are in this position in the first place, which I think is just a masterful thing to do, because it kind of also provides that even if argument that we often hear and we often entertain in the course of dealing with cases, right? The, you know, even if we did not look at this from a federal standpoint and, you know, in view of the U.S. Constitution, even if we looked at this in the narrow scope of the Georgia Constitution, the law would still fail, and here is why, or the law would still be unconstitutional and would offend the Georgia Constitution, and this is why. But, you know, we can look at it in against the landscape of the U.S. Constitution, and we can look at it against the logic that was articulated by U.S. Supreme Court justices. And in so doing, we still find that there are failings in the logic. I still find that there are shortcomings, and I would still find that this is, you know, an affront to the people of the great state of Georgia, and therefore the decision would still be the same. And that's what I think I love about it the most, is that really, you know, that really thoughtful even if kind of argument. So no matter how you look at it, the judge still says, you know, this is a bad rationale. This is a bad decision. And for the folks that live in this great state, this is something that we have to work to correct.
It takes a lot of guts for a trial judge in any state to take on a U.S. Supreme Court justice. And that's what Judge McBurney really did in his decision.
Better than Judge Cannon did, but yes.
That much better. He had some interesting quotes in his decision. I want to read some of these to you. And by the way, we're going to link you to the decision, the full 26-page decision, and we'll do that in our show notes. So if you want to read the decision on your own and not go with Judge Gale and my interpretation, please feel free to do that and take a look at this, I think, a masterful job of legal work. But let me give you a couple of quotes and get Judge Gale's reaction. One of the things that McBurney said is, whether one couches it as her body and should brook no government interference in what she does and does not do in terms of health, hygiene, and life. He's talking about the sanctity of a woman's body. Because of this constraint on the power of the state, people can engage in gluttony and self-deprivation. They can be free to tattoo or pierce any and every square inch of their skin, and ordinarily they can pursue or refuse a medical care elective procedure or one that is essential. He's basically giving the sanctity, Judge, of all of these decisions about one's body to the individual.
Yes. And that's, those are still rights that individuals enjoy even still and even now, which is exactly, I think, you know, one of the major failings of the rationale from the U.S. Supreme Court is not taking into consideration all of these other decisions that an individual can make about their own body, even still, and how that is not very distinct from this decision.
He went on and said that he acknowledged Georgia's competing interest in fetal life, but rejected the state's claim that anyone who engages in or facilitates termination of a post-embryonic cardiac activity pregnancy can be guilty of a felony under the Georgia Constitution. Until the fetus is viable, meaning it can live outside the mother and enjoy the protections of the state, he said, the only person in this great wide world who can by choice or legislative imposition maintain that pregnancy until it is viable is the pregnant mother herself. Unlike a newborn baby or a catatonic elder, both of whom our society should and does support if family and friends have stepped back from their expected roles as caregivers. For a pre-viability fetus, there is no one else who can assume that woman's role. That really speaks to the elevation of the woman being in total control of her reproductive system, does it not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it just so eloquently summarizes exactly the state of affairs at that particular stage. There is no ability to substitute in someone else for that mother at that point. Therefore, there's no one else who should be substituting their decision-making for that mother, and notwithstanding, again, the state's interest in protecting the life of the child, it is still at that particular juncture only one person who can and should and does have any ability to either protect or nurture or to ensure the life of that fetus, pre-viability.
One last quote from the good judge as far as the claim that it's up to the states to make this calculation and not judges. Judge McBurney wrote, this is his quote, "Women are not some piece of collectively owned community property, the disposition of which is decided by majority vote." And then he said, and he somewhat valiantly noted, quote, "It is generally men who promote and defend laws like the Life Act, the effect of which is to require only women. And given the socioeconomic and demographic evidence presented, primarily poor women, which in Georgia means primarily black."
Wow.
Wow.
And that's powerful.
Powerful. He much more eloquently than I said, you know, it's not for the fat ass white guys, you know, sitting on their asses in the legislature to decide what a woman needs to do. They're not property. They're not collateral. You know, they're people, and they're the only ones who should make this decision. That's so powerful.
And you know what is so interesting, in kind of pausing on that, you know, and thinking about that, remember, we're talking about Georgia, a southern state, a state that was proud of
a Republican judge, too.
Yes, yes. And you know, and legislature and governor and everything else. But think about also, we're talking about a southern state that was exceptionally proud of their role in the slave trade and in slavery when women, Black women, were no more than property, when Black women were no more than chattel, when breeding them was a form of, you know, increasing your commodities holdings, and they had no agency over their bodies or their decisions or their lives or anything. And to have, you know, moved hundreds of years away from that to where we are now, to have a judge that says, you know, essentially the people that are going to be most profoundly affected and impacted by the draconianness of this decision and this law are going to be the same people that as a state we degraded and we mistreated and that we demoralized for centuries is essentially, it sounds like that not on my watch kind of response.
Yeah, yeah,
and it
yeah.
is very valiant. It is refreshing. It is, you know, that was the one thing that I almost immediately hearkened back to is the fact that, wow, it at least feels like Judge McBurney gets it. He at least gets the correlation. He at least understands the parallel. He at least appreciates the connectivity between the two. Also, while, you know, listen, acknowledging, and I think he did that early on and saying, hey, listen, I'm not suggesting that Georgia doesn't have some interest in what happens here. But what I am saying is that that interest is not outweighed by the rights of these women.
The woman.
Yeah, the woman and these women to make these very, very important and personal decisions at these very important and personal points in their lives. And that should not be substituted by the decisions of any member of the legislature, any member of any government agency or entity, or anyone else. And so, no, we shouldn't be relying on that. And the flawed argument of, hey, we shouldn't let judges come in and decide these things is actually, you know, kind of a slap in the face because what
activist
it also suggests,
judges, right?
Yeah,
activist judges.
And it also kind of suggests that once the legislature does something this extreme, it lacking the foresight or even, you know, the interest in seeing around the corner on this, but they are perfectly content with you having no recourse. That is the point of having the court, is to have recourse when the legislature or the executive branch or anybody else doesn't get it right. When they don't get it right, it should be perfectly fine to then turn to the court to say, we need the court to correct this. And that's what's happened here. And it cannot be enough that the legislature only agrees with the court when the court agrees with the legislature.
Yeah. I agree 100%. Let's move on to Louisiana and let's not spend a lot of time there. But
why? Because they're worse?
Well, they're still at it. And the Louisiana legislature just passed a law, just went into effect, I should say. They passed it a bit ago, but it just went into effect, saying that the two drugs used in medication abortions have now become controlled substances.
It's worse than crack, Judge.
It is criminal to possess them without a prescription. Now, we're talking about mifepristone and also, I'm going to mess up the pronunciation, misoprostol. The two drugs, mifepristone is given first and then the second one is given a couple days later.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature calling these controlled substances says that the abuse of these drugs may lead to limited physical dependence or psychological dependence relative to the drugs or other substances. That's what a controlled substance is. So they're putting this right in there with fentanyl, crack, cocaine.
You name
your drug of choice.
Crack cocaine. It's just as bad as crack cocaine. Now, mind you, maybe not as bad as marijuana, because marijuana is legal in Georgia.
No, we're in Louisiana now.
In Louisiana, right. So mifepristone and misoprostol together can have the same effect as fentanyl, crack cocaine, heroin.
So what they're doing with this, according to commentators in Louisiana, is that the law obviously was not based on science or any public safety concern, but was to stop women from finding workarounds to the state abortion ban. A term that just came to me, it may be a term other people know about, is called advance provision, where they have them on these drugs on hand if and whenever needed. Mm-hmm. And that's stopped under this law. So you can't be prepared. You can't get it without a prescription, and you can't hold it in your house. How about that?
Remember, this is also the same state just a few short months ago that required the posting of the Ten Commandments in every public school. And so if that tells you anything about where the head of the legislature is in Louisiana on these things, and how disconnected the legislation is from reality, and the real life experiences of the folks that they are governing, I think that says a lot, because again, it is designed, as you said, to even prevent preparedness. So there's no way to be prepared. There's no way to respond, and there's nowhere. Or no, and it also even limits access through telemedicine.
It is
stunning, but it's also real. And you're absolutely right. Also, when you say there is no evidence that any of this is based on science, that is based on medical studies or research. These are literally the responses of just like gut checks and gut responses.
These are the fat ass white guys sitting in the legislature coming up with this stuff.
And saying, yep, this is how we're going to control it. And we're going to call these, you know, Schedule II drugs. We're just going to call them controlled substances. And we don't care if it... Because again, you know, we're already going to say that women go crazy, you know, when their hormones are skyrocketing and they're pregnant anyways, and they're going to go even more crazy if we let them have access to these drugs so that they can address their healthcare issues with regard to their pregnancies, because that too is an issue.
So, violation of this law is a felony. Yes. 5 years in jail, $5,000 fine. But the part that really gets me beyond what we've already talked about is that it allows the state to track the patient, the physician, and the pharmacy involved in each and every prescription. Yeah. So they're, even when it is properly prescribed,
they're watching you.
They're going to go back and question whether it was appropriate and necessary.
Yeah. And in many instances, I'm confident they're prepared to prosecute and, again, do that judgment substitution, right? To substitute their judgment for that of the doctors. And so imagine how you can disrupt even the flow of things, right? Because if you're a patient and you actually get the prescription appropriately from your doctor, you may have a pharmacist that just says, you know what? No, I just can't, you know, I've dispensed this too many times. And I just think they, you know, they came and questioned me last month and I just can't risk it. So no, you can't get your prescription filled here. And my goodness, if there's
very similar to the oxycodone and OxyContin statutes that we have. But there we have an addictive quality.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think any
woman is addicted to abortion. Not happening.
Oh, my God. And to suggest that that is the case, again, you know, this is the thinking of someone who's never gone through that experience and will never go through that experience to say, oh yeah, this is addictive. This is, you know, yeah, this is just what you do. So we've got to cut this addiction off. Really?
So Judge, we're looking at patchwork state laws where Trump and Vance are saying, hey, abortion solved, problem solved.
And this is exactly what you all wanted. You wanted it to happen this way.
Yeah. So we've talked about Georgia, their whole life statute now being unconstitutional. We've talked about Louisiana. This hasn't made it to court yet. This is just new legislation.
And here's the problem. What do we want? Do we want there to be another death? What are we waiting for in order to challenge it? Because that's the issue, is that you need something in order to challenge it. And unfortunately, you know, this may result in loss of life just to get this corrected. And that's...
I don't think they give a damn.
Yeah, who's going to be the martyr, the sacrificial lamb, in order to get it corrected? What family member? Because again, they don't until it happens to them, right? Until the very person that's sitting in the legislature and never thinks, you know, twice about the fact that, you know, their child or their loved one or their niece or their neighbor or their grandchild could be the victim of whatever, fill in the blank, you know, rape, molestation, you know, whatever the reason is. And all of a sudden, dang nabbit, these rules are in place that don't allow them to access the health care that they need. That becomes really, really telling, because you don't care until it hits home. And then when it hits home, then that's when you remember, oh, damn, there are some rules in place. And these are rules that I helped to put in place. And so, yeah, I guess we just got to either figure out how to skirt the rules or live within the rules and also deal with the fallout from either of those decisions, because there is fallout from those decisions. Anybody who says, I think anyone who sits back and says that anyone who has to abort a child does not have some kind of emotional fallout from that. You've never had that kind of experience. It's not like you're at the grocery store in a checkout line and you're deciding if you're going to buy, you know, a bag of potato chips or a box of Tic Tacs, you know, if you're going to, you know, pick between snacks. It's not that kind of decision. It is extraordinarily difficult. And what happens, I think, unfortunately, is almost all of these individuals are placed into the same bucket. Right? They're all just all considered, you know, well, these are just a bunch of, you know, perhaps irresponsible, loose, not very careful folks who just don't want to take care of their responsibilities. Well, there are just as many, if not more, instances when there's actual family planning that has gone into this, that has gone awry, where there are actual efforts to have tried to produce this result. And for some myriad of reasons, it just wasn't. That is not a function of irresponsibility. That is not a result of not being forward thinking or being prepared or ready to accept the responsibility that comes along with it. That is the definition of devastation when that decision has to be made.
And let's talk about miscarriages too, which has it's not a voluntary act.
It is not.
It happens.
It is not. It is, and it can be life threatening, right?
This is, and it's a form of abortion.
Yeah, exactly. You know, And here's the thing is what if we don't know anything right now, mind you, in the last, you know, few years or so, I think all of us as a general society, we probably learned more about this procedure than we've ever known in our whole lives and more than we care to know, especially if this wasn't part of your common vernacular. But at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. You're thinking and you're like, well, wait a minute, you know, this, there isn't a whole lot of difference between how you treat a miscarriage and how you treat, you know, a voluntary abortion. They're both healthcare. And again, in many instances, there are no other choices that are available. There, again, are some individuals who have planned and some family, this is family planning. They've wanted this their whole lives, and this has not worked out. And you are now leaving them where before they could rely on the input and the expertise and the insight of their doctors to help them make decisions as to when this was right. And now you've got doctors who have to stand in the corner and hear nothing, see nothing, say nothing until their patient is literally on death's doorstep and maybe actually crossing the threshold of death before they can even intervene to do anything, which very well may be too late. That makes for a less stable, less safe healthcare system for everyone. Because when doctors start exiting, because you have legislators consistently substituting their judgment for that of the professionals won't stay. They will.
And by the way, once we get this abortion thing cleared up, these fat ass legislators are saying, we're going to delve into birth control and IVF. Yeah. So not only are we going to handle the abortion, but we're going to go through the whole reproductive process.
Yeah, we'll get it all.
We're going to take care of it.
Yeah, we're going to clean all this up. All of this is a mess. We're going to clean it up. And by the way, isn't this what you all wanted? Isn't this exactly what you wanted? And I would venture to say that what we've seen, especially when voters have been truly given the right to respond, to vote, to decide, that they have resoundingly said, hell to the gnaw. This is not what we wanted. What we wanted is what we had and what you took away. And so we are earnestly working to restore what we had. And it makes no sense that we're working to restore what we thought was resolved for a generation plus.
So let's move on to Ohio in our last 15 minutes or so. And Ohio's interesting, your home state, my former home state. In 2023, there was on the ballot issue one, which was a constitutional amendment guaranteeing access to abortion in Ohio. It passed by 57%, 57%. And the intent of it was to make and carry out one's own reproductive decisions. Now, you think the legislature was satisfied with that, a 57% mandate saying we should have abortions? No, they still start tinkering with it, right?
Well, I mean, first they tried to tinker with how much it took to get it to pass.
Yeah, they tried to up it to 60%.
60% wanted to change the threshold.
And people went, no, we're not doing that. You know, we need a right to have some kind of input into our lives. So, that was a resounding passage. But yet there are all these laws swirling around Ohio to limit it. For example, you mentioned earlier in another situation, telemedicine. Mm-hmm. Just this August 29th, not too long ago, Hamilton County's in Cincinnati, by the way, if people don't know Ohio. A common pleas judge there by the name of Allison Hathaway issued a preliminary injunction that extended temporary restraining order, halting the enforcement of a law banning the use of telemedicine in medication abortions. Why would anybody want to do that, to limit telemedicine? But she had to jump in on a case filed by Planned Parenthood and others to say, no, this is not right. It goes against what the state just passed.
And what the voters just said.
They just said,
this is what they want. Stop trying to stand in the way.
And the law also, the telemedicine law, prohibited non-doctors such as midwives, advanced practice nurses, physician assistants from prescribing the abortion pill, mifepristone. She went, no, that's unconstitutional too. You know, I have to give her credit. She jumped on the bandwagon here, but we still have legislators believing they know better than 57% of the population.
Well, and legislators who know better than the population, better than the doctors, better than the judges. Because remember, you know, we only agree with the judges when the judges agree with the legislature. And then otherwise, we call them activist judges. And we tell the population, even when they, you know, deal a resounding loss to the legislature, you know, the legislature then responds by telling them they don't know what's good for themselves. And so they've elected the legislature to protect them from themselves. So they have to step in, thereby kind of making them, you know, the overseer, the quintessential end-all be-all to all decisions for their own constituency. And I think that's where the lines really get blurred. And, you know, the elected officials kind of forget who the bosses are. The bosses are the people. The people elect them to represent them, but their job and their responsibility is to actually reflect the values of the people who put them there. And this is a clear example of how that has been lost.
According to the Ohio Capital Journal, there's a guy by the name of Peter Range, a senior fellow for strategic initiatives at the Ohio Center for Christian Virtue. He said that it is now clear that the ACLU of Ohio and Planned Parenthood and others fighting Ohio's abortion restrictions are, quote, are after every common sense law which protects mothers and babies in our state. This most recent ruling is just another example of how they want abortion on demand without any restrictions whatsoever. We need a return to common sense laws which protect women and protect the preborn in Ohio. What's your response to that? What's your reaction to that? You're a judge. You get public criticism all the time. I did, you know, but you see something like that, you just want to go, give me a break.
You know, and that's exactly, that is the very nice way of putting my response.
I cleaned it up.
I'm going to say a very diplomatic way of saying that would be, give me a break. Because what I would like to, I would love for this gentleman, and I use that term loosely, to really appreciate the fact that there are more lives at stake than the ones that they kind of limit in this argument. And I think there's also another side to this that we don't always touch on, and that's because, I mean, as judges, we really do try to stray from the politicized argument. But I'm going to stray just a little bit, and then we can weave it right back to the courtroom in a second. And I say that because the argument that this man made just kind of struck me when you start talking about the fact that, you know, essentially you have folks who want abortion on demand, which again fails to take into consideration all of those instances when an abortion is actually the last thing a couple or a family want. They actually want their family and they can't have it. And this, the short-sightedness of this. But even if, or even in those instances where for whatever reason the pregnancy is not desired or cannot or should not be carried through the term, and then there's this argument that, you know, this is really just murder and we should, you know, we should ban this. The fact of the matter is that you have so many politicians who have not, they haven't cut a hole in the social safety net. They have literally set it on fire. And so the question becomes, when do you really care about life? Because it seems that you, there's only care and concern as long as it's in utero. Because once the child is born, there are little investments that have been made in education. They're
child care.
How about, you know, housing? How about health care? How about all of the things that it takes to ensure that the once the child gets here, it's actually safe, healthy, cared for, loved, nurtured, provided for, educated, all of those things. These are all the things that are required and are necessary to help ensure a healthy life once the life gets here, but are yet all of the things that some of the same individuals who are fighting to take the right to choice away, they're also fighting to take away all of the other stuff that's absolutely necessary to ensure that the child has and lives a healthy, fulfilling life. I find that to be kind of the height of hypocrisy.
We just want the child to be born. We don't give a damn what happens to the kid once the kid's born.
Precisely.
Yeah, that's what.
And
that's
how
what
the hell is that pro-life?
And how dare you get any kind of welfare or public assistance? Yeah. You know, and how dare you want a free lunch or a free breakfast
at
school?
How dare you want medical care? How dare you want an education? How dare you? How dare you? This, it sounds just barbaric and it sounds inhumane and it sounds immoral, but it also sounds exactly like what they're arguing for.
Well, Judge Hathaway, one last quote. She said the amendment that's issue one that granted people's right to abortion in Ohio by 57% of the popular vote. The amendment grants sweeping protections ensuring reproductive autonomy for patients in Ohio. Plaintiffs have provided substantial evidence to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the bans in the legislation at issue violated these newly enshrined rights in a manner that is not the least restrictive and actually causes harm to patients. Amen. Judge Hathaway.
Yes. Thank you, Judge Hathaway. And thank you, Judge McBurney.
But here we've got three different situations, and that's why I picked these. We've got Georgia with a state judge taking on the U.S. Supreme Court and finding a statewide abortion ban unconstitutional. We've got the Louisiana legislature making it tougher even to get a non-surgical abortion and trying to criminalize people who even have the drugs to do it.
Access to the medication.
And we have Ohio where the people have spoken saying, we want this. We have a constitutional amendment, and yet we still have legislation on the books trying to restrict things like 24-hour waiting period and no telemedicine. And how can we chip away at this public right? This the three examples that we've talked about today is what Trump and Vance are talking about as the sending these matters back to the states. This is a patchwork. You have a different ruling in Ohio than you have in Georgia, than you have in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
You are absolutely right. And I think it's intentional chaos. And, you know, I think I heard this the other night where it talked about, you know, the lunacy of forcing someone to receive a level of care based on geography. That is insane because it really does mean life or death for some folk. It really, and we know this because we've seen it happen.
Yes.
Yes. And it documented. Never should have happened.
No. No. Well, we want to thank you for listening. This has been a spirited discussion. We both sort of got on our high horse today, but the whole purpose is to explain what it means when you get a catchphrase like send it back to the states. It mm-hmm. is chaos. It's a patchwork of chaos. And I think, Judge, you stated that very well.
And thank you so much for your really deep and informative analysis here of these three state approaches to this. I know we'll be revisiting this topic again. This is clearly not the last of it.
The Supremes start Monday, so that's right. God knows what's going to come out this term.
You're absolutely right. So, you know, folks, if you're listening, buckle up because we're expecting. I think we're going to have, you know, another topsy-turvy term with the U.S. Supreme Court, and this John Roberts Court is so it's fairly unpredictable, disappointing, but fairly unpredictable.
Judge, one quick thing. I want to give our listeners an update. I think it was two episodes ago, we did a show on judicial decorum, and we talked about a judge in Detroit taking a student who was in his court and basically totally embarrassing the student. Incarcerating her, making her go through a search, putting her in jail garb, et cetera. There's been some further developments, correct?
There has. That judge was initially given a break from the bench and put in, you know, a little bit of a judicial timeout. He's since been returned to the bench with some very, very limited responsibilities. He's now back. He's back serving the court, but his responsibilities are really, really limited to some very fairly low level and inconsequential traffic matters, which I don't know if that's part of a greater design to maybe build empathy and to help the judge in other areas of his professional life and recognizing how best to deal with or handle these situations, because they are no doubt going to present again. But right now, at least, I think the general public can be comforted, perhaps, if that's a comfort, in knowing that he probably won't be handling the more serious matters, at least not in the immediate future.
And the child and the parents of the child may, in fact, still have civil action against the judge and the court for the abuse of the child. So putting the judge back on the bench, even in a limited way, does not bar the people from going forward in a civil complaint.
Oh, absolutely not. And I will actually venture to say they could probably bet on
that's going to happen.
Lawsuit coming.
that's going to happen.
The judge, emotional distress is probably pretty pronounced.
How do people find us, and what should they do once they do find us?
Well, we are hoping that you enjoy these conversations that we have and that we are helping to increase and improve your knowledge of this court system that we have certainly become so endeared to. So we ask that you continue to check us out. Look for us on any platform where you get your favorite podcasts. First and foremost, we'd ask you to check us out on our primary sponsor of NPR, National Public Radio. You can find us there. And if, in fact, you catch your favorite podcast on other platforms, you can look for us as well on Spotify, Amazon, Apple Play, and anywhere else that you might get them. We ask that you subscribe. Certainly like us, especially if you've been tuning in and you keep tuning in. We do welcome you as a regular listener, because our goal, as we've said before, is we know that you don't trust what you don't understand. And so we work to help improve your understanding of this justice system. And so thank you for joining us, for tuning in, and for hanging out for yet another episode of Next Witness, Please.
And don't forget to rate and review us. Please do that, because that really helps us out and gives us good feedback. And you can also give us feedback. You can shoot me an email if you would rather do that. You can do that at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. And if you have suggested topics for us to cover in the future, or things that you want uncovered or more knowledge about, just shoot me an email and we'll add you to the list. It's a growing list that people have asked us to address, and we're trying to get to as many as we can as soon as we can. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back really soon to give you more insights into the law and our legal processes. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.